It was really interesting to see him talk about like artistry and directing and these stories and stuff like that. So I'm apparently on the fucking Jonah Hill bandwagon. Please don't do anything horrible, Jonah.
Don't be our next milkshake duck.
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 51. I'm your host, Anita Sarkeesian, and I'm joined by my fellow experimental drug patients, Ebony Adams and Carolyn Pettit.
What up?
Ooh-wee. You have no idea.
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love. Or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. Today's show is all about Maniac, the Netflix show about trauma, mental illness, and difficult relationships. After that, we'll finish by each sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout? Now on with the show. Yo!
Hey! So this episode's a little different.
Is it?
Logistically on our end.
Oh, right.
Or, oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I moved to LA.
Yeah. I need to move to LA. So we're no longer recording in the Keanu Reeves Memorial Studio each week.
Is that what we were doing previously?
Yeah.
That's what Carolyn and I called it.
Yeah, I never told you that we officially named it, but it was officially the Keanu Reeves studio was the name of the
studio. Is there more
studio.
Context to this?
No, just Keanu Reeves. Just, you know,
cool.
Ebony
cool.
and I both have a certain fondness for Keanu Reeves, so it was the Keanu Reeves studio. I felt like, I didn't feel like I needed to bother you with, you know, such a minor organizational decision. Yeah. I felt like I could just kind of push that through
I would have put
own.
A sign on the door and everything.
Yeah.
It's too late now.
It's not too late for you to, you know, what's the word, to name... That's not the word I'm looking for, but you can go ahead and call your new studio the Keanu Reeves Studio. In fact, we should all call our studios Keanu Reeves Studio A, B, and C. Like movies, characters. So like I could have the John Wick Studio.
Yeah.
Oh, I want
that. I could have the Scanner Darkly Studio.
I want the
You could have the Point Break Studio.
Oh, yeah.
Ah, yeah, yeah. I mean, Johnny Utah is like the coolest Keanu Reeves character name. I would have... Anita would have the Johnny Utah studio. I would have the Johnny Mnemonic studio.
Yo.
Okay, so this is not super relevant, but slightly relevant. So you know how I've talked about Point Break Live and how amazing that show is? Have I talked about that? We haven't talked about Point Break on this podcast, have we?
Well,
totally thinking of a different podcast. Apparently, there's now a Top Gun Live, which we have talked about, which we have to go to.
Yeah, I'm down.
I know.
I'm so down. Is it in LA?
Yeah, I think so.
Anita.
I know.
Field trip.
I know. Carolyn, you're going to have to come down for this.
Yeah, that's definitely an excuse, a good enough excuse for me.
Hell yeah. All right, Carol, what do you got for entertainment news?
All right, so BlizzCon, the annual Blizzard entertainment event, happened this past weekend. And video games continue to be awful. Blizzard announced at BlizzCon that they're releasing a game called Diablo Immortal, which is a...
Oh, no.
Yeah. So, which in their, you know, from their description is like, it's a fully... I just lost the word I was thinking of. But, you know, it's a fully fledged Diablo experience on mobile, et cetera, et cetera. And like, look, I do not find this announcement exciting. I don't find it interesting.
Hey,
I think
Carolyn.
It's,
How many times have you played Diablo 3?
Oh, Anita. Gosh. So let's see. Now, just to recap, I had to review it when it was originally released at GameSpot. Then they did a big patch for the game, and then I had to re-review the full game after the patch. Then they put out the expansion, and I had to review the expansion, which is basically like reviewing Diablo 3.
Sure, because... The whole game is exactly the same from beginning to end.
Yeah, yeah. Like how much? It's you know how much can you find to say about like just killing monsters and getting stuff, getting for killing
Get
the monsters.
That loot. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so the Diablo Immortal announcement was a certain subset of gamers who identify very strongly as gamers are extremely upset about this announcement, right? They so according to there's a story in PC Gamer about the quote unquote severe backlash Blizzard is facing following the reveal of of their Diablo Immortal mobile game, with fans calling the announcement a, quote, slap in the face.
Oh, my gosh.
most of the anger...
Because mobile's not hardcore? Is that what the backlash is about?
It's specifically because, like, it's not, like, for them, right? It's not for the, like, hardcore, whatever, PC gamer Diablo fan. And because Blizzard, I get not caring, right? I don't care. But, like, the rage, like, the tremendous rage that is being directed at Blizzard because they had the temerity to, like, announce that they're putting out a Diablo mobile game is just, it's so
exhausting,
disheartening and frustrating. It's so emblematic of, like, the entitlement, again, at the heart of gamer culture, where everything Blizzard, everything the studio does has to be, like, for you. It has to be, like, with you in mind. If they create anything that maybe isn't for you, it's, you know, it's a, quote, slap in the face. Like, what the hell, people? Just don't play the game.
Oh, that's so frustrating.
The range of emotion.
Yeah.
You know, like the haste, the celerity with which people rush to rage when a game doesn't, like, tickle their particular boxes, like, right away. I laugh at it a bit from the outside because I am not a gamer, either, you know, in italics or in regular print. And so I'm just like, what are y'all doing? I mean, I can't imagine taking anything that seriously. And I'm including things like Star Trek and Doctor Who in that. Like, this is the rage and the joy with which they find other people to be mad with. You know, like, it's like anger communities.
Speaking of taking this, like, a little too seriously, to continue reading from the PC Gamer story about the backlash, the story includes this detail. The game's cinematic trailer has received more than 200,000 dislikes compared to just 7,000 likes. The top comment, which user Red Pill Shark claims has been deleted 8 times. So this is the user, you know, who's like, complaining the most about this, their username is Red Pill Shark, says, quote, "No king rules forever, my son. I have played your games for the last 20 plus years and will never forget my first encounter with Thrall. Goodbye. You have changed, old friend."
Oh, what? My God. That is so embarrassing.
It's so embarrassing,
it's like
right?
These people are living within a Thomas Covenant novel or something. Like, they see, whoa, this is awesome. Maybe I need to start living my life with this kind of intensity. I mean, yeah. I don't think I have the energy. I'm going to really need to take some B vitamins for this, but y'all, you need to stand down. This is ridiculous.
It's, yeah. Oh, my God. You know, and it's like, I laugh at it, but also there is that aspect of like, oh, like this, that level of like entitlement is not just about like when, you know, the creation of a mobile game that's not like designed for you in mind. It's related to all of the things. It's related to, you know, the pushback against representations of women and queer folks, you know, better representations of women and queer folks and people of color in games. It's, you know, it's, there's a not too ambiguous link from there to, you know, the alt-right politics of, you know, Breitbart and Trump. So it's, you know, it's just, I want to laugh, but also I realize like, oh, this is not actually like, it's not just silly, right? There's like something kind of dangerous here too.
Yeah.
Oh, totally. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the fact that these people are hanging every piece of their identity upon the replication of a certain type of media that has to date always centered them is dangerous. Yeah. So we can laugh at it, but the fact is it doesn't stay on keyboards. It doesn't stay on, you know, mobile screens. Like, this anger radiates outward in really dangerous ways. Yo. that no king is king forever. I'm going to start saying that. I'm adding it to my lexicon. And I'm going to start with you, Anita.
Oh,
whatever
boy.
You and I disagree. That's where I'm going.
Cool.
In other entertainment news. All right, so Rebel Wilson.
Oh, Lord. Oh, my God. Okay, sorry.
Are you ready for this, Ebony?
No.
Are you prepared?
No.
All right. Well, here it comes. So Rebel Wilson has a film coming out soon called Isn't It Romantic? It's a romantic comedy. And on Ellen DeGeneres, on the Ellen show, Wilson said, quote, "I'm proud to be the first ever plus-sized girl to be the star of a romantic comedy." Also on Instagram, Rebel Wilson wrote, "I'm proud to be the first plus-size girl to be the lead in a studio rom-com. Plus, this is the first movie I get a producer credit on." So she was, you know, making a big deal out of, like, her role as, like, yeah, the first ever plus-size star of a, you know, of a rom-com. Oh, except, you know, little point of technicality, she's not, actually. As many people pointed out, you know, Queen Latifah and Monique, at the bare minimum, those two, you know, black women have starred in romantic comedies. And so when this was pointed out to Rebel Wilson on Twitter, she replied, "Yeah, I of course know of these movies, but it was questionable as to whether, one, technically those actresses were plus size when filming those movies, or two, technically those films are categorized slash billed as a studio rom-com with a sole lead, so there's a slight gray area."
No, that's not how you respond to that.
No.
A lot of people are saying, you know, no, the gray area is just like you... not really, you know, because those films star black, they have largely black casts, they star black women, they are, you know, they have they're culturally sort of considered niche, you know, black films, whereas a film starring Rebel Wilson is, oh, it's a mainstream film, it's a film for everybody, right, as opposed to, oh, this is a film, you know, for black audiences.
It's so funny to me how it would be so easy for folks when they're caught out making statements like this to just say, "Yo, you're right. I messed that up, and you know, I'm glad to, you know, have my film join this line. We need more films with plus size or fat heroes, heroines, etc." Right? But there's always, like, these folks always double down. They always double down, and it's like this whole conversation took a hard left, and it didn't need to. And then the response from Rebel Wilson has been to block all of the black women who have pointed out to her that, like, no, you know, you got this wrong. And all of the ones that the responses from black women, you know, like media writers, cultural commentators, etc., took it in, you know, good spirit and were like, "Oh, hey, you know, no, you're actually not the first. Here's Queen Latifah and her extensive filmography, and here's Monique and whatever, and here's where you're wrong." And so these very sort of, you know, funny, you know, civil word of the day kind of responses to her provoked her blocking people, you know?
Yeah, there's a kind of amusing tweet from Lauren Duca that read, "Rebel Wilson's block list is the closest we're ever going to get to an official roster for Black Twitter."
For real?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Rebel. You know, not a good look with your movie coming out, but... It absolutely does highlight the ways in which, you know, black films are always already, you know, sort of slotted into, you know, a certain place.
Yeah, exactly.
In Hollywood, both in terms of their production and their reception. And so the implicit assumption is, oh, yes, these smaller things happen, but this that I'm talking about now, starring white people for white people, is a more culturally important version of it. And this is the one that you should pay attention to. Like, how hard would it have been for her to just be like, "Hey, I'm from Australia. You know, I haven't seen a lot of these movies. I've heard of them, but I spoke too soon," or whatever. Like, oh, people, you can just take the L sometimes
and keep it moving. Yep. Yeah.
Wait, what does take the L mean?
Like take the loss. Like,
oh,
just kind of,
right. I wouldn't advise people being like, "I'm from such and such country," but I think that you could be like, "Oh, you're right." Or be like,
reasonable to say, like, hey, I'm a white Australian woman. These movies were not marketed to my community, you know?
Yeah, like, but I would still, she would get super attacked for that because, like, you should know better before you make statements like this.
I don't know. I think it's whatever. You know, I think, you know, people can say, like, this is where I'm from. And, you know, the lack in my knowledge may be, you know, I may be culpable for that. But here's just an explanation of why these things didn't immediately come to mind for me. But I'm going to do better. But anyways, yeah, Rebel Wilson, I know her PR people are getting no sleep right now.
Speaking of no sleep.
Anita, are you not sleeping?
I'm not, but I was actually trying to transition into Maniac and I couldn't, it didn't land.
I'm sorry. I stepped on your segue. Do it again.
No, it wasn't a good one anyways. Okay, well, before I get into Maniac in our main, I will say that, speaking of no sleep, so October was a really intense month for me and us at Feminist Frequencies. Ebony and I went on a book tour, and then I packed up my entire life, and then I went to a convention, and then I moved. So every day of October felt like a month. And I say that not so you could feel bad for me, which you totally should, but that I watched Maniac like in this timeline like 12 months ago. So I'm trying to like really jog my memory about the show. But that's what we're talking about today is Maniac, which is this Netflix show who is created by Patrick Somerville and directed by Kerry Joji Fukunaga. Sorry if I said that wrong. And it stars Jonah Hill and Emma Stone, who are patients who are trying an experimental drug treatment for trauma. It's actually based on a Norwegian TV show of the same name, but this is the sort of American Hollywood version of it. And it is, I would say, like, I found it quite interesting, even though it had, you know, some gaps in the structure of it.
I highly encourage people to watch it. I basically loved it, but and no, which is not to say that I didn't have moments of like, you know, or whatever. But on the whole, I really admired it.
Yeah, a lot of the reviews I looked at were pretty consistent in their appreciation of the show. But there was a lot of discussion about style over substance on this. And I don't think that I agree with that, although I don't think it's necessarily a negative. I think that like the stylings of the show were fascinating, and that the director who he had done, I believe he was the director on the first season of True Detective and is doing a Bond film. He has a very interesting visual style that pulls from a lot of like Maniac specifically pulled from a lot of different like filmic influences. And I think that the wackiness of it was really compelling, especially for a topic such as like, you know, trying to deal with heartache and trauma and drug abuse and like challenging families. And so like the chaoticness of it, I think did work, even though I think some of the narrative of it kind of ebbed and flowed.
Structurally, there's actually been a really interesting conversation around Maniac because according to comments by the director, the Netflix algorithm was basically used to determine to a large degree the narrative shape of the show.
What does that mean?
So Fukunaga said in an interview, quote, because Netflix is a data company, they know exactly how their viewers watch things. So they can look at something you're writing and say, we know based on our data that if you do this, we will lose this many viewers.
Wow.
So it's a different, So it's a different kind of note giving. It's not like, let's discuss this and maybe I'm going to win. The algorithm's argument is going to win at the end of the day. So the question is, do we want to make a creative decision at the risk of losing people? There was one episode we wrote that was just layer upon layer peeled back and then reversed again, which was a lot of fun to write and think of executing. But like halfway through the season, we're just losing a bunch of people on that kind of binging momentum. That's probably not a good move, you know? So it's a decision that was made 100% based on audience participation. And a lot of critics have taken issue with this. They've said, like, a piece in Collider by Ron Gilmer titled Kerry Fukunaga, Maniac, and How Netflix's Algorithm is Becoming Entertainment's Skynet. The writer, Ron Gilmer, says, you know, checking off boxes that fit what Netflix thinks will appeal to their subscribers is a dangerous path to head down.
I guess that explains why the show is so watchable, even with its like big structural flaws.
And I also think it's fascinating to think about. So this is a show that is all, it's like all about like humanity and human connection on one level, but it's also there, it has a computer that is very important, like narratively within the show. They're kind of trying to rely on a computer to fix, quote unquote, fix damaged people to some extent. And this show itself was to some significant degree shaped by, you know, computer data. So that's just, that's just fascinating for me to think about.
I'm afraid my reactions, such as they are, to the show, I really enjoyed it. I did not expect from the trailers that I had seen, nor preliminary conversations that I had listened to, that I would be at all interested in this show. And so initially, when it was added to the editorial calendar for the podcast, I was like, oh, Jesus, here we go. I watched one episode. I felt as if I was reading an Omni magazine from 1982, and I was in. I was in.
Yeah.
Like, visually, this tickles all of my funny bones, you know? The show is, I think there is a case to be made that it is tremendously self-indulgent. In a way, but because it is the way I would indulge myself visually, I really enjoyed it. And I also really enjoyed, we're veering away from the conversation y'all were having, but just follow me. I really enjoyed getting to know Jonah Hill as a different sort of actor in this show. So he's not someone that I have, whose career I have followed, but the things of his that I have seen have all been those kind of like Judd Apatow style comedies. And he's been fine. He's very charming, in those sorts of roles, but he's not someone whose oeuvre I gave a shit about. Right. But there was a tenderness and a quietness, to the pathos he displayed in this show that I was so drawn by. I have to say though, in terms of like, the quality of the acting of this show, Emma Stone is a wonder. Like, she is absolutely phenomenal to watch. The way that she inhabits the sort of primary character, and then the kind of interiority of the different characters that she takes on once we, you know, go into these mindscapes. Like, I was just blown away by how good she was. But I think, you know, in a way, I was kind of more blown away by how much I enjoyed Jonah Hill. I don't think he was quite at Emma Stone's level, but I was like, yo, I didn't know Jonah Hill was capable of this.
So right, that's on. The thing is, like, I think that I'm like a legit fan of Jonah Hill, which always seems weird to me because I've always associated him with these like really sort of raunchy, silly comedies that I never really enjoy. But when I saw him in Moneyball, which is a movie I really liked, I was like, oh shit, like, he's really good. And then seeing him in this, I was like, I really like his serious acting. Like, I'm very, I just, he breaks out of the mold that he had been thrown into because he started acting when he was pretty young, I think. And so this, I feel like this is a nice, like, reveal for his work. And then I saw Mid-90s, which he directed, and I saw like this Q&A with him, and it was really interesting to see him talk about like artistry and directing and these stories and stuff like that. So I'm apparently on the fucking Jonah Hill bandwagon. Please don't do anything horrible, Jonah.
don't be the next milkshake duck.
Yeah, right. And then my thing with Emma Stone is I think she was good in this as well, although it's hard for me to forget that she's Emma Stone. And I'm always like, so I loved Jennifer Lawrence in Winter's Bone, and like some of the other work that she did. I think that she was an incredibly, incredibly skilled actor, but I feel like once you get to a certain level, you become the like performance of the person as opposed to like falling into these characters. And so I kind of feel a little bit that way with Emma Stone, where I loved her in Easy A and like followed some of her early career around that time and thought she was great. But then she just became like Emma Stone. Which is a little disappointing. So I feel like this was a good role to let her do something a little different. But also, I just never forgot it was her while I was watching it.
Yeah, it's a weird function of fame, right? Such that, you know, completely outside of the responsibility or ability of an actor on the screen, we bring to it certain expectations and, you know, a certain context that they can never truly escape, right? So I didn't have the same reaction that you did. I was able to forget that I was watching Emma Stone. I was that captivated by her performance. But I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, for instance, like Gabriel Byrne is in this, right? And he's someone that I absolutely love seeing every time he shows up. And yet I'm always conscious when I'm watching him and like, oh, that's Gabriel Byrne. Like I can't somehow divorce who he is and how much I love him from the actual work he's doing. That's not his fault. It's just simply the way that I, you know, enjoy him.
Yeah. And some actors, obviously, some actors are more respected for being the kind of chameleon actor who can like disappear into a role. You know, you have the Gary Oldmans mm-hmm. of the world for like the, just as the first person who kind of pops into my head. And then there are those actors we like, because there's the comforting familiarity of them doing, of them being who, bringing their screen persona that we already know and associate with them into films. Like maybe Tom Hanks.
Jeff Goldblum.
Not to say that Tom Hanks can't act, because I think he very much can, but, you know, it's rarer for him to do a kind of a role that is not kind of the Tom Hanks role that we kind of like seeing him in. So, but I think, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think Emma Stone absolutely has that ability as an actor. And I think that she's lately been hired a lot to just do the Emma Stone thing, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. But it is great to see her in roles that maybe that ask more of her as an actor, because I do think she definitely has the chops.
Yeah.
To do
how's this for a segue? Like one of the hard conversations about Emma Stone is the way, I can't remember the name of the movie that she was in.
Aloha?
Where she, you know, played someone who was half Asian, I believe, right? And all the furor over that, right? I would like to talk about race in Maniac because there was some really interesting stuff that I wasn't quite certain how to understand it and how to unpack it, specifically the role of like the Japanese as kind of a, you know, technologically obsessed culture, you know. And again, you know, when I talked about how it felt like reading an Omni magazine from 1982, there was a way in which this series harkens back to the kind of obsession of the 1980s in like science fiction film and literature with the specter of Japan and Japanese scientists. And I wasn't quite sure how I felt about it. Obviously, I understood it or tried to understand it in one way because the director, Kerry Joji Fukunaga, is, you know, half Japanese himself. He's mixed race. And one of the main characters, Dr. Fujita, I think. Am I right? Dr. Fujita is played by Sonoya Mizuno, who is also Japanese, right? But I don't know. It felt like I couldn't pull it apart, really. I don't know.
Yeah, there is this sense in Maniac of Japan as this like shadowy technological empire, and the characterizations of Japan that we get in terms of like the character who we never see but who is obviously like the head of the pharmaceutical/technological company, I guess, that's providing the funding for all these trials and everything. Like, it does rely on a lot of stereotypes about Japan as this kind of, that kind of, again, that mysterious technological empire that I was definitely like a little uncomfortable with that. Like,
yeah. And the way that like the scientists, you know, when they're about to, you know, execute an order, start speaking Japanese, whereas before they speak English. And it's this very sort of like intense, but kind of almost militaristic, you know, declarations that they make. It's like there's, as you say, this allegiance to this sort of like shadowy, possibly nefarious,
right,
mysterious, you know, Japanese conglomerate in the background that we aren't quite sure what their motivations are. And so, you know, when the show first started, I wasn't sure where it was going to go. But then as we get more, as the character of Dr. Fujita, for instance, is developed more, I started to feel a bit more comfortable in it. But yeah, it did harken back to me to it felt very 80s, you know, this sense that, like, you know, the Japanese were not quite sure what they're doing, but they're up to something.
Well, also of the four main characters, only one of them is a person of color, which I think is, you know, like the director is, I believe he's Japanese, but like, so it's not appropriative in that way or anything, but I feel like it's a bummer that the main cast is all white in this world that is clearly very influenced by Japan.
But that's the thing. I think maybe that's it. You know, like the main cast that we spend time with, whether it's Jonah Hill or Emma Stone or, you know, your boyfriend, Justin Theroux.
Right? Love him.
And, you know, many of the people in the drug trial, not all, but many of the people in the drug trial are white, right? But they're being operated upon. They're being subject to this Japanese conglomerate. That's what felt weird to me, you know? It did feel, and so I was like, huh, that's very interesting that, you know, that Fukunaga, you know, who is Japanese himself, or as I said, mixed race, I think his mother is Swedish or I'm not sure, but white, you know, that he wrote and directed something like this. I just thought it was very interesting, but I wasn't quite sure, you know, I wasn't entirely, you know, I found it a little unsettling at times.
Yeah.
I want to get into a bit the what I think are the sort of core themes of Maniac, about trauma and connection and things like that. You know, at one point, so Justin Theroux's character is kind of the guiding force behind the treatment, the drug trial, and you know, at one point he says, his character says, "I believe in this treatment. I believe we can be fixed." That's the word he uses, fixed. And it just made me think, like, because this is a big part of what Maniac is about to me, is like, can we be quote unquote fixed, and to what extent? Like, because it's like, on one hand, of course there are traumas and hardships that nobody should have to experience, but also those become such a formative part of who we are. It's like, is there some ideal version of us that somehow, like, goes through childhood and into adulthood, like, completely unscathed? And is that, like, a better version of us? Would that version live, like, a more fulfilled life, you know? And or to what extent, I get, like, does the pain we experience make us possible of capable of being more compassionate or better able to appreciate the joys in life? And I think the main kind of way the film, the series explores this is through...
Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert!
Rosebud is the sled!
Like, Emma Stone's character lost her sister in a really terrible way, so, you know, a few years prior to the events of the series, and has to live with not just the loss of her sister, but, like, the way that she herself was behaving in the lead up to that, and like, all the horrible, like, things she said and did to her sister before, you know, before the accident that took her sister's life. And should the treatment kind of erase that entirely? You know, ultimately, Emma Stone kind of faces it and kind of in a way does, like, learn to kind of say goodbye to her sister and kind of let go of it. I guess I should have allowed a spoiler warning before that. I just don't know. I don't know how to talk about what the series is doing.
Well, what I think is interesting about this from sort of like a therapeutic trauma perspective, yeah, is, you know, when we talk about healing from trauma, you know, and some of the work that is done, or the treatments that are done around that, is the idea isn't obviously of forgetting, which, you know, was something that was explored in Eternal Sunshine. That wasn't trauma as much as like a breakup, but, you know, I think sometimes we want this like magic pill that'll make it go away, that will forget the pain that we live with. But that a lot of these treatments, you know, obviously that's not what happens. The treatment is to make it less activated, right? That, like, when you think about the experience, it's not triggering, or it's not like it becomes like almost any other thought to some degree, I think is sort of the goal for trying to deal with trauma. And this is an interesting way of looking at that because it is a treatment, right? It's like a literal, like in 3 days, you will be free, quote unquote, of your trauma. But I think it is kind of like it's rooted in this psychological understanding of you work through the motions, right? It's like exposure therapy, which is a questionable practice for a lot of trauma. And that somehow you will feel calmer or more at peace once you've gone through that procedure. And I think what's interesting with Justin Theroux's character is that he, speaking of someone who's the actor behind the character, he, you know, clearly came at this from like having like a pretty traumatic childhood with his mother, who was, you know, a psychologist who was not really a good parent. And he was kind of trying to one up her and like make her field irrelevant and solve his own problems through that process. And so the complicated messiness of the person behind the treatments also being someone who needs the treatments, there's so many layers to why everyone is in this particular moment and in this particular place.
Yeah. I love, so there's a scene, like actually the first scene where I think we meet Justin Theroux's character is, you know, he's been kind of kicked off the project. Something happens and they need to bring him back on. And so in his apartment, you know,
oh God, that is so gross.
He's basically playing a virtual reality porn World of Warcraft. Like he's basically literally fucking a World of, you know, like a World of Warcraft.
And there's like
character.
A device on his dick.
Yeah. Like that's what I mean. It's like full on the stimulate, you know, the physical stimulation, the whole, you know, the visor, the whole nine yards.
But it's so DIY too. Like it's not even,
yeah.
It's kind of like ancient legacy tech, like he put together out of like two coffee cans. Oh my God.
And we understand ultimately that, oh, I mean, as fucked up as it is to be like, for him to be seeking solace in this, like, you know, very big breasted, sexualized, video game fantasy character, like we do understand that at the core, like there's some guiding principle there of like him, he's going about it the wrong way. It's not going to be fulfilling in meaningful terms, but of him reaching out for some kind of connection in that. And I just anyway, that scene was just incredible.
Yeah. And I think that one thing we sort of bypassed in our conversation earlier about the environment and the time period is I think they do a really good job of setting up this like dystopian capitalism with things like ad buddies. So in the world, if you can't afford something, you get someone who comes over to you and reads you ads while you eat your lunch that they just paid for example, or like, you know, Annie, Emma Stone's character, talks about like going to Salt Lake City. And she's like, can I use ad buddies for that to get from New York to Salt Lake City? And they're like, I guess. And so it's like a human that goes with you on this like bus for 3 days just reading ads to you. And I'm like, and then there's friend services where you hire a friend to like, they do all this research into you and they pretend to be there for you and know you as if you're like buddies. And it's just, I was that part of the world building I was really taken by. Like I thought it was really disturbingly well thought through.
It's super interesting because I think Bell Hooks has written about this, and it's some of the work of hers that I respond to most, like how loneliness and lovelessness and like a lack of community is kind of one of the great ills of modern society. And I found like Maniac's world is so interesting in that it's totally a capitalistic world, and the capitalism is like the cause to no small degree of the kind of isolation in which a lot of people live. And of course, capitalism doing what it does and capitalism being what it is, capitalism is also trying to provide the solutions for that at a profit, like in a profit generating way, right?
We're just running out of time. One other thing I just wanted to point out was that, like I said earlier, that the direction was clearly influenced by previous films, like notable films. And so I noticed there's a reference to The Graduate, And there's a reference to, I mean, his apartment, Owen's apartment, is fully Blade Runner.
Oh, like, totally.
I was like, oh my God, we just transported into another movie. And there was one more that I can't remember. And I'm curious if someone has done like a deconstruction of, I'm sure there's way more that I don't recognize, right? And so I'm wondering if like someone has deconstructed all of those sort of visual nods to other influential films. So I thought that was interesting in this world that's so specific too, right?
Definitely. And, you know, the connection between the Jonah Hill character and the Emma Stone character is kind of like in a way, it's like the heart of the whole series. And, you know, I mean, I definitely get all the style over substance criticisms of this series. But as someone like, it's no surprise to people who like follow me on Twitter and stuff, that things like connection, human connection to me are like the most important kind of theme that we can kind of deal with in art, or at least one of them. And so ultimately, like this is not a subtle series. It is very, very blatant about like the importance of human connection and finding, you know, real connection is like what matters most. You know, it's but I didn't mind that it was so overt about that, like because it did it in such style. It made it more palatable than it would have been if it were some kind of like, it's not like a, you know, like a bland back to school special, like connection is the most important thing kind of thing. It like feels, it really emerges in organic and fascinating and exciting ways from the characters and the situations they're in. I really like that, that the two main characters don't like, you know, kiss. I mean, there's one scenario in which they're husband and wife in like New Jersey, and maybe they kiss there, but it's not like really them. But as friends, at the they don't. Their connection isn't like rooted necessarily in a romantic. I mean, maybe it goes that direction at some point, but like within the context of the series, it's not like dependent on that being part of the connection they share with each other, which I really like too.
Yeah, I mean, a show that features a purple koala playing chess is absolutely not subtle, but the points that it was making about caring and about finding those people or recognizing and allowing people to care about you in all your ugliness and the black moments just really resonated for me. I was so, I thought, yeah, there's some potentially like, you know, kind of mixed up messaging in terms of, you know, mental health therapies. But I found for the most part, the heart of this film, when it talked about, you know, mental illness and trauma, was so smart. And one of the things that I really loved is the way it showed how fellow sufferers can offer the kind of tough but necessary empathy that is something that you can be most receptive to. So, you know, Owen comes in with, you know, an entirely different sort of mental map than Emma Stone's character. Owen is a schizophrenic. So it's not that he, you know, suffered the kind of, you know, sudden onset trauma that Emma Stone's character did. He is a lifelong schizophrenic, right? And he's been suffering from hallucinations. And the fear that he is able to share with her and the way that he has, you know, kind of explains why he has retreated into himself. She doesn't offer him, you know, these kind of like pat aphorisms about, you know, oh, you'll get through it, or, you know, every day is a new day to be better, or just get through the next 5 minutes and then 5 minutes after that. Like, she offers him a real kind of tough empathy that acknowledges, like, yeah, you know what? It's fucked up, and that's shit, and it sucks. And sometimes that's what's necessary, someone to just hear you and offer you that kind of, like, you know, that to become like, you know, a comrade in arms in the struggle. I found that really moving.
Yeah, totally. I maybe in the bonus for this week we can talk more about the computer And
Gerda.
The, you know, like, because what Carolyn was talking about with connection, I think the computer is a huge part of that. And then also, we have not mentioned Sally Field. So check us out in the bonus if you want to hear more on this conversation. It is now time for What's Your Freakout? Ebony, you go first.
Okay. I recently, I've been rereading some kind of key YA texts from my childhood. There were two books that I had been searching for kind of without hope for a long time because I couldn't remember their titles and I had just sort of vague memories of what they were about. But I remember reading them, I think both of them in sixth grade, and I was desperate to kind of find them again. And just by happenstance, found them both this weekend. They both are sort of like these time slip novels about kids. And it absolutely spoke to me as like a weird kid to think like, yes, I am a person out of time. I was never meant to be here. The people around me don't recognize that, you know, my interior greatness. So it just like had a weird moment of connecting with Baby Ebony this past weekend. The two books were Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme. T-I-M-E, you get it? And then one called In the Keep of Time. But the thing that I'm freaking out about is that both of these books are, I think, from the late 70s, early 80s. I'll have to go back and check. But I read a lot of YA. It's so interesting to watch the development of the genre and language over time within a specific milieu, right? So I'm rereading these books. And although I am enjoying them and on some level just as much as I used to, there are things now, it's not that I'm getting more as an adult, but there are things that I wouldn't stand for now. And I'm thinking specifically about how in one of the books specifically, there's just like this really horrible kind of fat shaming and disability shaming that's so, you know, woven through a you know, certain characterizations, but it's so banal. It's just everyday. It's just sort of accepted, and it was really kind of jarring to read. So yeah, just thinking about the past is a foreign country, you know, they do things differently there. It was really interesting to go back and reconnect with these books from my childhood. So that's my freak out.
Nice. Carolyn, what are you freaking out about this week?
So this past weekend, I did some streaming on our Twitch channel, twitch.tv/femfreak. And at one point, I opened it up to viewer raffles. I let viewers, you know, winners of raffle choose which game I would play next from, you know, like my available, readily available little library of games. And at one point, somebody chose Prey, the, you know, the recent...
Oh, God.
Yeah, Arkane Studios game, and
new one, not the old one.
No, not the old one. No. We don't
like Jesus.
We don't talk about the old one, except when we do because of how problematic it is. But and like Prey is a game that I've tried it a few times before, you know, and I think I just I don't know, like maybe I just wasn't in the right headspace before to. Because it's a game that you have to like pay attention in. You know, previously I just found myself getting killed a lot, and you know, I sort of bounced off of it in a way. I just didn't really get into it, and for whatever reason this past weekend, like, I was just in a place where I was like more receptive to what it's doing, and really started enjoying it. Obviously, you know, Arkane, makers of the Dishonored games as well, known for their great, like, sort of world-building skills, and that stuff is fully on display here. There's a really fascinating kind of alternate history timeline that Prey establishes, in which the Kennedy assassination failed, and that sort of leads to like all these advances in space travel and stuff that anyway bring us to the point where of the game. It's like really scary, but also now that I'm like taking it a little slower and paying attention, I have a better handle on the mechanics and like how I can deal with the threats in the game. Whereas before I just was like, I don't know what I'm doing, you know, because there is a lot going on in the game, but, and it's easy to, if you're not kind of, paying attention, to maybe kind of find yourself a little lost or overwhelmed. But, now that I'm allowing myself to kind of be immersed into the game, its mechanics and its world, I'm only like a few hours in, but I am fully on board and really, really enjoying everything it's doing. The atmosphere, the fear elements, the narrative, which has a lot of kind of twists and turns and psychological, you know, stuff to kind of keep you second guessing yourself and everything. I'm way into it. So I can't wait to play more of it.
Nice. I am freaking out about a book. So on the live XOXO show, I talked about The Collapsing Empire by John Scalzi, and he just released the follow-up to that book called The Consuming Fire. And it's really good. And I like it.
Cool. Sold. I should put that on the back, like as a quote. It's yeah, really good. I like it. I need a Sarkeesian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I got. You know, it's a sequel, so like you have to read the first one to read the second one. Like it's not like a standalone thing. But you know, it's a space opera, and it's about a universe that's about to collapse and how they're going to deal with that and the politics of it and all the different factions and who is believed and who isn't. And, you know, there's some kind of fun characters in it. They're pretty short books. Like I got through both of them really quickly. And I'm actually a pretty slow reader. So I liked it. I recommend checking out the series. I think it's going to be a trilogy, but, you know, I don't know how these things work. So The Consuming Fire.
Who knows how do they work?
I don't know. The series is called the Interdependency Series, if you want to check it out, by John Scalzi, who you would know from Old Man's War is probably his most famous. Red Shirts, duh, obviously. I still haven't read that. I should add that to my list.
Yeah, it's fine. It's good.
The audiobook is narrated by Will Wheaton.
Pick it up.
Yeah. Anyways, all right. This week we have a guest freak out. So Jamie Moffat has something that they're freaking out about.
So my freak out is for Clementine Ford's new book, Boys Will Be Boys, Power, Patriarchy, and the Toxic Bonds of Mateship. The title might make it sound like it's a dry feminism 101 text, but that would really be selling it short. Clem is an incredibly funny and insightful writer, and the book examines a lot of, you know, what is toxic masculinity, patriarchy, and rape culture, and how to be an intersectional feminist, and all of that through the lens of recent events, both here in Australia and worldwide. But it also explores the fact that she recently had a son, and what that means from everything to how to raise a boy without toxic masculinity in today's climate, to the division of housework. As you can imagine, it gets incredibly dark in places, but then in the next breath, she'll be discussing giant piñatas shaped like Judith Butler, and you'll burst out laughing. People often joke about books that you'll laugh, you'll cry, it'll change your life. Well, that, but unironically for this one. She's also an incredible public speaker, and she narrates the audiobook herself. I definitely recommend giving it a look.
You can submit your own freakout, and it might make it on the show. So just head over to feministfrequency.com/freakout. That's FREQOUT. All right, that's it for today. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. Stay tuned for the bonus episode, which I think we're going to talk more about Maniac in, and it's only available if you are a backer of this podcast, which you can be very easily. Just head over to d.rip/femfreak. If you're enjoying the show, please rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and tell your friends too while you're hanging out in treatment facilities.
Oh my gosh.
Like, I know you got a lot of downtime. Here's a great new podcast for you to listen to. You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com, and be sure to follow us on Twitter @FemFreak to stay up to date on all the news. You can find us individually as well, and we may or may not respond to you. Carolyn, where are you?
I am at Carolyn Michelle.
I'm at Anita Sarkeesian. And Ebony, where are you at this week?
Pill A.
Pill A. Cool. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music, technical support by Sarah Narales, and art by Jamie Varon. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.